Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Fred Obiero.
Thank you for joining us today, Taiwo.
Oh, thank you for having me, Fred.
Awesome. First question, what was it that drove you to get involved in the machine learning field? And for the sake of our listeners who may be unfamiliar with machine learning, do you mind describing that as well?
Yeah, definitely. I'll go to the last question first. So what is machine learning? I'd like to define machine learning as the art of finding information from data. And it could be any kind of data. It could be massive data, small data, but just finding that information or that insight from that data and being able to use that insight to benefit an organization, a country, or a course. That to me is machine learning. And what drove you to machine learning? Actually, that's a very interesting question. For me, I think what drove me to machine learning, taking a couple of years back now, which is probably like 5 years back, I used to work at Intel. And while I was at Intel, I was one of the lead engineers that drove a concept then 5 years ago, which was kind of new then, Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. So we started that project. And when I started that project, one of the pinpoints of that project was that this was going to be the next revolution and it was going to drive the generation of massive amount of data on a scale that nobody else has ever seen. And that once this happened or happens, then there's going to be a need for ways to harness that data. And that the fact that there was going to be that explosion, that was what drove me to understand even more about what IoT was going to curse. And because of that, I started looking at so many journal articles, and lo and behold, I found out that machine learning and artificial intelligence, narrow AI, strong AI, were going to be the eventual solution to data explosion. And that curiosity drove me to multiple different universities. I eventually went back to school, Berkeley, and even now Stanford, just to try to understand ways whereby we can harness that data. And the curiosity, obviously, is what has driven me to become much more of an expert in this field, just because I want to understand how we can harness insights from data.
Wonderful. What are some of the major trends in artificial intelligence that you foresee dominating the industry within the next 5 years?
That's actually a very interesting question. I think in the next 5 years, taking a look at where we're at today, and you can probably already foresee what we will be experiencing in the next 5 years. So I expect that having started 5 years ago from IoT, I expect that IoT is going to eventually explode within the next 5 years. And I expect that there's going to be a lot of information out there, information from edge computing devices, information from even cars, et cetera. I think there's going to be, we'll probably be generating as much information, which is happening today, as we've generated within the past, probably 10, 20 years, we'll probably be generating those in 2 years, within the next 5 years. And then we'll also be seeing, we're going to be getting slowly to the age of strong AI. So right now what we have is mainly narrow AI. So narrow AI in this sense is basically aspects of AI that can do the work they know how to do, but they can do it well. So like natural language processing, being able to understand human sentiments, et cetera. But now generalizing that to, well, you have a robot that can understand human sentiments and can also identify human faces. So then we're now progressing to much more strong AI, whereby AI itself is now becoming much more autonomous. So the age of self-driving cars, et cetera, those are things that I see becoming much more real life or showing much more real human benefits within the next 5 years. So they are no longer like research terminologies, but they are actually working or they are in our everyday life and we're using them and we're just aware of what they're doing. Basically, they become tools that we use every day, just like we use cars today, without actually realizing that they are artificial intelligence products or outcomes.
I actually like the example you just provided about self-driving cars. Do you have any specific use cases that you can share with us on how the data goes from the data acquisition and harnessing all the way to how that translates into self-driving cars? Any high-level experience that you can share?
Oh, that's a very good question. So self-driving cars technology, the main brain behind self-driving cars technology is basically the sensors and eventually the algorithms that run the information from the sensors. So different sensors for motion detection or just detecting distances between your car and the next car, the car next to you. And then you have other sensors, which in this case cameras, which basically give you information, visual information about the environment. So from harnessing data to actually being able to create a self-driving car type technology. So you can think of it in just a basic concept. Let's just break it down into smaller concepts. And I'll probably talk about just one concept. Let's think of the concept of actually steering the wheel of the car. So for you to be able to steer the wheel of a car, you need to be able to know if there's a person in front of you or if there's an obstacle. In this case, let's assume the person is an obstacle. If there's an obstacle in front of you, if there is maybe a stop sign, if there is a traffic light, etc. Now, seeing all of this, we can eventually identify all of these features in an image, which you can capture in a camera. Now, a camera working in real time is processing many, many images. And those many images, you can pass them through what is called a convolutional neural network, which is a visual recognition algorithm that can eventually tell the driver, or in this case, the algorithm that does the steering, of whether there is an obstacle in front of it or not. And so if it actually sees a stop sign, the algorithm has been processed to, okay, well, if there's a stop sign, probably you need to stop. And then it sends that information from the steering wheel, I mean, all the way through to the steering wheel and eventually also through to the brake, the accelerator, et cetera, of the car, and tells the car to stop. So the car stops. Well, in the situation whereby you actually see an obstacle in front of you, let's assume the obstacle is a car now, and then probably the next step for the algorithm now is to tell the steering wheel to turn by a specific number of degrees so that it can basically not crash into that obstacle. So there's just so many different sensor type technologies or feedback loops whereby you see a signal, where the signal in this case can be either a stop sign or it could even just be lines on the road that tells the car, hey, guess what? You are driving in the right direction. So because of that, you need to keep the steering wheel angle to be at this same neutral position it's in. Or, well, guess what? You're pivoting away from the central position you're supposed to be in. And because of that, I can see that the lines are becoming much more diagonal. And so we need to actually get the driver or the steering wheel now to turn in a different direction or in a different in a counterclockwise direction or clockwise direction, as the case may be. So that's a very high level explanation. I mean, mm-hmm. I can go into more details if people want, but it's just a concept of just visually recognizing or visual stimulus, as well as sensory stimulus in terms of like distance and being able to adjust parameters, including the steering wheel, including the brake, accelerator, based off of the stimulus you obtain from mathematical algorithms, including CNN, convolutional neural networks, as well as sensors.
What are some of the biggest pain points that companies struggle with when implementing machine learning?
Good question. I think there's so many issues that come up when dealing with machine learning algorithms in general. And also the next step in that is also so many issues that come up even when trying to productionize these algorithms. I think one of the biggest issues definitely with companies that are starting up is they struggle with data. Data itself is the building block for any machine learning type architecture or project in this case. So if you don't have the data in the format that is easily digestible or a data that is just fragmented everywhere, guess what? You're probably going to spend a number of time that you could have spent doing a lot more work with the development of the algorithm. You're going to spend that time just trying to get the data in a format that you can eventually use. And you probably, everybody's probably aware of like GDPR and other privacy issues. So if you right. don't have the data in a format that is usable or in a format whereby you actually have access to it, guess what? You need to get access, and access can take a number of times. Or can take a lot of time. And so one of the issues that I see with many companies that are just starting up is definitely just gathering that data. And then another problem that you can think of happening with companies is that they now come into a situation whereby after they have the data, they've developed these algorithms. Now productionizing machine learning algorithms is also a very, very humongous task for so many companies today. And one of the reasons for that is just because machine learning is still relatively new. I mean, now we have many big companies like Google, like Microsoft, like Amazon that are they're into just delivering architectures that can support different types of machine learning algorithms in production. However, for companies that are just coming into that sphere, there's a lot of heavy lifting that has to be done in terms of, okay, well, what kind of security you have to provide to these, to the machine learning algorithms or to just my entire machine learning system? What is the privacy that that needs to be an added feature to my machine learning system to cater to my customer needs? And then do I need to ensure that there's no bias in my machine learning algorithms, et cetera? I mean, these type of issues, they may not come up necessarily as being very important, but down the road, they become really, really critical for the company, especially as the company becomes much more publicly recognized. And those are the pain points for many companies as they try to productionize or as they try to move into the machine learning sphere and get production grade machine learning algorithms to their customers.
You've talked about the GDPR law in Europe. You've talked about, you know, having data that's being stored in different formats and the need to normalize that data before it's being harnessed for machine learning. What strategies can you share with us on how to best overcome some of these challenges that you just alluded to?
Very good question. I think for GDPR, the best strategy is just follow the GDPR convention. That's actually very, it's a very comprehensive type of architect or law that has been put together by the European Union. And I'm pretty sure the United States is going to follow suit at some point also, because data security and human are just, we having the power to control our data, that is as essential as it can be. And it's going to become more essential as our data becomes even much more weaponizable in the future. And then also just talking in terms of like infrastructure availability or just productionizing these algorithms. So most companies, eventually what they leverage like AWS from Amazon, they leverage Google Cloud from Google or Microsoft architectures, because those architectures, they've been built to cater to production grade systems. So most companies tend to just rely on the security provided by these big organizations. However, some industries, and you can think of some industries that have a much more streamlined need from their customers in terms of privacy, et cetera, they might find that to be something that their customers will not want to happen. I don't want, for example, you can have a situation where a customer does not want any of their data to be on Google Cloud or to have access, or they don't want Google to have access to any of their data. And you can come into issues like that. And then that is when the company would have to follow a much more aggressive approach of trying to get all these hardware and softwares, including security softwares, on site, on-prem, and then using them to eventually build their own architectures. And that's a very, very, it's actually a very expensive undertaking right now for any Series A, Series B company. However, bigger companies can easily try to have access to such infrastructures.
One follow-up question on GDPR before we move on. So let's say you're a small company based in the United States. Do you necessarily have to factor in GDPR laws while you're gathering and harnessing this data? Or is that something that you only have to worry about if you have, let's say, a user base that includes European Union citizens? What's your thought on that?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think right now, most companies eventually, or most startup companies, I mean, if your customer base exclusively is in the United States, then you may decide to opt away from actually following the GDPR. But even today, I've gone to several other companies like Slack and the rest. Even today, even if they're not in the European Union, they do actually try to follow that convention, because the GDPR right now is actually, you can think of it as the gold standard, because there's no other standard available even today in the United States. So people tend to just want to follow that, even though they are not high in the European economy or European database or European customer base. But eventually, I think most companies that start out in the US eventually somehow manage to get into an European kind of setting. So people tend to follow or want to actually mimic or at least abide by GDPR rules before they get there rather than after, because then it becomes much more of an hassle when you are already like a standardized company and then you need to now take your standard and then merge it to GDPR, which you've not been following from the onset.
In what ways can organizations better prepare themselves to leverage this vast amounts of data that they have in order to fully benefit from the utilization of machine learning techniques? Do you have any specific case studies you can share with us to that aspect?
Definitely. I think most companies will benefit from harnessing just a huge database of information by, number one, just having allies, just machine learning and artificial intelligence allies in the C-suits, in the echelons of power. Because what happens is that sometimes many companies actually have that, they really want to do machine learning, but they don't understand the entire development lifecycle of machine learning algorithms. Like, everybody wants a computer vision model to be able to tell if one face from another face. Everybody wants a speech recognition algorithm. Everyone wants a language translation or translation algorithm. I mean, but most people, what they think about is that, oh, well, I want a language translation algorithm. I'm just going to hire a machine learning engineer and it should come out in like a month. I mean, obviously it's possible that that's going to happen. But I mean, what happens is that sometimes most of the algorithms, even off the shelf, they still need some form of tuning for you to eventually be able to match them to your own unique user or unique problem statement and be able to get excellent results. So in that light, having an ally in up there creates a better, what's the right word to use? It just makes it a lot easier for you to have that chain of communication open. Hey, you know what? These are the steps we need to get through, you know, for us to be able to take this to production. And so people kind of understand and appreciate the work that is being done. Else what's going to happen is that you hire in, or most companies hire, most new companies, newbies into machine learning, I'll call them that. They hired all these folks and they want something that is going to work tomorrow, today. And what happens is that the machine learning engineer is like, hey, guess what? We have to do all these steps, but then there is no appreciation of all these steps until you actually get to a product. And most companies can get frustrated in that journey. And when they get frustrated in that journey, most of them stop halfway. They're like, oh, you know what? We're done. We're just going to go with the process we used to use before, and that's it. So having allies is a good, it's definitely a very critical part in the process. And then also just having the infrastructure or understanding if there is a need for an infrastructure to be available. And infrastructure in this case can be software infrastructures or hardware infrastructures. So if you think about it this way, some machine learning algorithms require intense computation. Some machine learning algorithms do not require as much computation. How do you know off the shelf if these are when you're going to stumble on this problem? And having that insight is definitely very helpful for your company, because you can plan ways ahead, you can plan ahead, you can start solving problems even before they start, so that you don't get into this kind of like into this plateau whereby everybody is expecting something, but guess what? There's another problem that comes in along the way, and there's another problem, and then it just continues to be like a never-ending series of problems, and then there's no product at the end of the day. So just having that, number one, having an HALA, and then number two, having a plan or a map of what the entire journey has to be and how to combat the issues that you eventually, you know, you're going to encounter eventually along that journey to getting your, from getting the data to actually productionizing the machine learning algorithm.
This actually leads to my next question, and this is around cost. So as we all know, cost is a huge factor when it comes to the collection, accumulation, and processing of big data. What are some of the strategies that you will recommend to efficiently drive the basic economics of cost management, where a company doesn't have to pay too much for data storage compared to the outcomes that they're getting? At what point does the realization of ROI become relevant? Can you speak to that?
Good question, definitely. Definitely cost is, it's always a big problem, especially as you can imagine, when you have to deal with either taking hardwares or softwares, these are very, very expensive initiatives. And so for companies in their infancy stages, so we're talking about companies like in their Series A, B, most of those companies today, I think today, most of them always default to, and I think I talked about that previously, default to using Google Cloud, AWS, et cetera. And I mean, the reason why is just because it's just very cost-effective for them to use platforms that are already available, that are relatively secure, and that is widely used and widely recognized. And it's basically, it's also available in different regions around the world and easily deployable. So people tend to just stick with those, especially when they're starting up with developing their machine learning algorithms. And obviously, I mean, and you can think of like the fact that when you're now thinking about like just harnessing data and storing data, companies have sprung off of just the concept of having data readily available at lightning speed for processing. It's like, just like Snowflake, we just IPO'd, they work on providing cloud-based storage mechanisms and cloud-based storage and retrieval architecture for multiple different applications. So companies, startup companies default to those because they provide a cost-effective approach to eventually just getting the either harnessing data or eventually working on that data, which is basically computing on the data and deriving insights from the data and eventually creating algorithms that would enable inferences to be made on that, to be made on the data. However, when companies start getting bigger, when companies become the Amazons and then the next Googles, obviously then you become a company that you actually also require your own compute resource. And you don't, just to take a step back, you don't actually need to be the next Google or the next Amazon to require your own compute resource. Some companies also, because of their user base or their customer demands, actually require that their data be kept in a physical location that is secure and is not accessible by any other person. So that can also drive a company to eventually have a need for them to have all these compute resources on premises. But like I said before, most companies, to be cost effective, they use cloud-based solutions. And even some big companies today are still using cloud-based solutions because it's just generally very cost effective rather than having everything in-house, having to deal with the cost of getting those hardware and software, the cost of managing them, updating them, upgrading them, just cost of electricity, because some of them, I mean, most of these servers and the rest, they use power a lot. So it's just very, very cost effective in the short and in the long run for users to harness the widely available cloud-based resources today.
I come from a project management background, and I'm curious to know, what role does project management play in your profession, and what strategies have you utilized to ensure its effectiveness?
That's another good question. I think project, product, and program management is actually very, very important in machine learning. And I need to actually be very honest about this. I didn't think about how important it was until I started taking on really, really big projects. And then that's when I realized that, I mean, actually one of the main reasons many machine learning algorithms or projects fail is because of lack of project, program, and product managers on those teams at the beginning of the project or at the early onset of that project. And even today, I still feel there's still very limited number of people that just have that project, program, or product management skill set that is tuned to machine learning. And so the reason why I say that is because most people that have the product, project, and program management skills today, most of them have actually been trained in like Scrum or Scrum, and those are much more attuned to software engineering. I mean, I'm not taking anything away from software engineers, but machine learning is still a developing field, like I said before. So sometimes when you're actually trying to productionize a machine learning algorithm, or you're looking at productionizing an algorithm, there's still a step that is lacking in most of the project management approach today, which is the research phase. Now, there is more than likely going to be a research phase, except this has been done before. There will be a research phase whereby you cannot run in the same cadence as you would in like a sprint type approach, whereby, oh yeah, in the next 2 weeks, you should have this done. But what's going to happen is that, well, you're trying to look at different ways to make your algorithm eventually solve a solution. And once you get one way that works, then you write an algorithm that follows that step. And then you get a data set, you train it, and guess what? There's going to be a repetition in that specific, in that cadence, because sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. So having like a project management background and then having some sense of machine learning is very, very helpful, because it kind of lets you understand that, guess what? There can be an iteration in some of these loops, and we should actually take that into consideration when we are dealing, when we're trying to create timelines for when projects should get done, et cetera. Coming from a project management background, I think there's a lot of opportunities available in the machine learning space. I mean, I just think just having just the project management and just marrying that with a bit of high level understanding of machine learning, I think it's going to make the person basically one of the most sought after project engineers in the next 5 to 10 years, because we are going to have a basic need for many more project managers, program managers, and product managers that have this kind of skill set eventually in the future.
You've talked about going to Berkeley, going to Stanford. And for this last question, we have a lot of listeners. Some of them are recent, you know, MBA grads or people that have several years experience in the industry. And they'd probably want to know, what has helped you get to where you are? And what word of advice would you give to someone that wants to pursue a career that's similar to yours to this point?
That's a very interesting question too. I think I would probably make two quotes, which are probably the only two quotes I'll make in this podcast. Oh, so Jeff Bezos once said, you don't choose your passions, your passions choose you. And then there's also a new Harvard research that was probably last year that said that to be successful, you should chase your purpose and not your passion. So just putting those two together, I think one thing that I've actually mastered at doing, and I think anybody can master doing, is to chase your purpose with passion and grit. Because I think I've been driven to where I am today just because I saw a need while I was working in the manufacturing industry at Intel. And I just felt like that need needed to be purchased. Now there's been a lot of setbacks. Like I said, you don't have an ally in the echelons of decision making, et cetera. So there'll be a lot of step back. Oh, it's not gonna work, it can't work. But guess what? If you chase that purpose with so much passion, you just know that, you know, I think this is gonna work. And then you're like, okay, you know what? I'm gonna take it to the next level. Let me go back to school and see how people, how professors are teaching this and how people are gaining this kind of skill set and professional background. And so basically having that purpose and chasing that purpose with so much passion will take you anywhere, which is what has taken me basically to several institutions. And I think it's going to take everybody, I mean, it's going to take people through different paths, and eventually the all the paths is going to lead to is just that person having or becoming an expert in that field. And in terms of machine learning, just having that that open mindset that, guess what, this field is changing, and then education in this field is basically lifelong. You have to just keep learning because the field is still new, relatively new, and it's going to keep changing. So chasing your purpose with passion and just having that open mindset, I think, is going to take you anywhere and everywhere in the field of machine learning.
Taiwo, this has been a very fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Fred. I really appreciate it.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.